Welcome to Green and Red, Scrappy Politics for Scrappy People, a regular podcast on radical, environmental and anti-capitalist politics, brought to you by Bob Bazanko and Scott Parkin.
3, 2, 1, and we are recording. Welcome to the silky smooth sounds of the Green and Red podcast. I'm your co-host, Scott Parkin, in sunny Berkeley, California. And as always, I am joined by
Bob Bazanko in sunny Niles, Ohio. Might be the best weather in the country here. Oh, seriously. So
I also am in a beautiful spot, less than a half a mile from the ocean.
Yeah, I'm not that close.
Yeah.
I'm about a half mile from Mosquito Creek.
That's close. That's close enough. Before we get started, I just want to remind people that our program is made to the generosity of our audience. So please consider becoming a patron at patreon.com/greenredpodcast or making a one-time donation at thegreenredpodcast.org by hitting that support button. Today, we are going to be talking about, I don't think we've ever done an episode on our subject today, but last week there was a very fancy opening at it was actually classy, more than fancy, opening of a library, of a presidential library in the Chicago area. It's the Obama Library. And being that there has been so much attention on that, and it was such a lavish event attended by all the living former presidents, but not the current living president.
Is he really living?
Yeah, the mummy, swamp creature who now has his own swamp in the reflecting pool. We thought we would do a little bit of a look at the Obama legacy, his campaign, his presidency, and maybe a little bit of his post-presidency with a little bit more of a critical eye than you may have heard at the Obama Library last week.
Yeah, I'm sure that shocks people. It was really this orgy. Liberals were happier than they'd been in 6 years, probably. They point out, look at how classy Barack and Michelle Obama are, and look at the bipartisanship. Bush was there, and he and Michelle Obama have become BFFs, even though when people criticize Michelle Obama as a man or put memes out portraying her as a monkey, Bush is radio silent about it, but they're best buds. And it's just typical liberal stuff. Isn't that great? Look at how they got along. Honestly, all of them should have been in the Hague, get together. That should be the class picture and a docket together, but neither here nor there. We'll talk about that. But anyway, so we want to, just kind of give, we've done these before. We've done a lot on JFK, which is one of my favorite things. We've done them on Jimmy Carter. The difference there is Jimmy Carter genuinely became a really noble and inspirational figure afterward. Can't say that about these guys. And so today, Obama, which is, and he's really iconic among liberals. They still fondly look back on those days. And I don't want to bury the lead because this is critical. He's the first African-American president, and that's a big deal. The night he was elected, I was shaken up. I was like choked up by it. Growing up in a certain era, living through, watching on TV those scenes from the civil rights era, people being beaten, people being attacked, the urban uprisings, to see an African-American named Barack Hussein Obama become president was shattering to so many of us. And for a moment, we thought, maybe America's not so bad. It's not where we think it is. I think we're wrong. But at any rate, I don't want to, that's critical when you start talking about it. You don't want to bury that. That's very important. And I think at the moment, inspiring.
Yeah. Hey, I honestly have been a radical anarchist for a long time. And I cried like a baby that night at his victory speech that he gave in Chicago the night he won.
I was choked up, and seeing Jesse Jackson out there crying actually did more to me than Obama.
And also, to his credit, there were a couple times to the presidency where he would give a speech and it was like really choked me up when after the massacre at the Black church in Charleston, and he sang Amazing Grace to the audience was also a really powerful moment. And so,
and that's his legacy, right?
Yeah. And so he could give a hell of a speech. And just to start there is David Sirota, who's a journalist and he's a campaign consultant. And he wrote an article for The Nation in 2006 about whether Obama's progressive bona fides were real or not. In 2006, he was the darling of the progressive movement. And so Sirota spent the day with Obama when he was Senator Obama before he was planning to run for president. Before he ran for president and eventually became president. And his takeaway is that Obama had some positions which the progressives liked. He was against war. He talked about equality. He talked about healthcare. He talked about the climate crisis. And in 2006, we were deep into the Bush presidency, the halfway through the second term. And so I think people were looking for what Obama really campaigned on, which was like some hope, right? And that's what he's like, that's the famous Shepard Fairey graphic. And it's a picture of Obama that says hope. And so many other graphics have been a play off of that. But I think there's something that is really important here is that he actually framed himself as a pragmatic progressive. And so to me, that's actually rhetorically, that's the opening where he's going to basically do the bait and switch to the right, which is actually what we see a lot of politicians do. And so I think we had a idea that this may be on the way, but definitely people did not want to. And I was in big progressive communities in the late 2000s, leading up to the 2008 campaign, and they were all in love with Obama. And, you know, there was like this moment where you actually thought maybe he was going to do some sort of New Deal redistribution of some wealth or what have you. And then he does the bait and switch, which is what we're going to get into.
Yeah, he had burst on the scene in 2004. He had done a keynote speech during the convention that year, the one where Kerry was nominated. And he's very charismatic, a very powerful speaker, talks about reaching out. There's no blue America. There's no red America. There's just one America. At that point, becomes a media favorite. He's young. He's charismatic, like I said. Gets elected to the Senate, and he's pegged at that point as an upcoming star, a rising star. But nobody assumed it would be that soon. By 2006, he announces a run for president. And the Democratic Party today really still hasn't learned that lesson. The fact that he emerged out of nowhere to become what he did really was indicative of a deep distaste and frustration with the establishment Democrats. The one, same ones in many cases were still around today, like Pelosi and Schumer. They were there then, right? Obama really was a manifestation of that frustration, of that desire for change, hence the hope of change stuff. But even then, there were people on the left who were like Sirota, but even more who were skeptical of him. But even in Sirota's article in 06, right, you can kind of see that one of his first votes in the Senate was to vote a class action reform bill, which had been opposed by consumer groups and civil rights groups. It was actually a way to protect businesses and corporations who filed bankruptcy, who screwed over customers and so on. Obama was in their corner, right? He went to Connecticut during an election there and endorsed Joe Lieberman. If you're older, you remember Lieberman, hawkish, horrible guy, ran as Gore's vice president. One of the most avid and zealous supporters of Israel ever, very much like Schumer, right? Who was running at that time against Ned Lamont, who is currently, I think, the governor of Connecticut. And Lamont at the time was a progressive. And Obama went to Connecticut and campaigned for Lieberman against Lamont. And that kind of pissed a lot of people off. And then when talking about healthcare, which will become a signature issue, right? Obama, because that was big. Remember, I think Howard Dean in 04 had turned that, really opened the conversation on that in the same way that Sanders did more recently, right? But Dean, who was a medical doctor, talked about single payer. So everybody was talking about healthcare. That healthcare crisis didn't just pop up, right? And Obama had to respond to it. And he said, I don't think in ideological terms, I never have. Everybody who supports single payer healthcare says, look at all this money we would save from insurance and paperwork. That represents millions of jobs, blah, blah. But what are we going to do about the people at Blue Shield, Blue Cross Blue Shield and Kaiser and so on? So it was clear that from the start, from the jump, he was not in favor of any kind of single payer program, any kind of Medicare for All program, any kind of national health care. Finally, another issue that will define him would be the war in Iraq, and not as much, but in Afghanistan too. And that was crucial to his victory because during the campaign, he took a strong stand against that, both against Hillary Clinton and John McCain. But he came around slowly. In the earliest days of his Senate residency, he wasn't that clear-cut about it. He didn't talk about it very much. He voted to confirm Condoleezza Rice, who was peddling WMD lies and had not recanted from them. And it was only after more established and even hawkish Democratic officials, I think the guy from Pennsylvania, Murtha, Jack Murtha, spoke out against the war, which was, that was a huge story.
That's when Obama started talking about it. And by
it's also, Murtha was a Vietnam vet too, right?
And by 06, there's not a lot of risk. By that time, the American people had really turned against the war badly, right? So he was, as you said, very cautious, very timid, but very charismatic. And then by 2000, and again, another canary in a coal mine that the Democratic Party still ignores, he defeated Hillary Clinton for the Democratic nomination. And Hillary Clinton had been around by that point for 16 years, first lady senator from New York, the most qualified presidential candidate ever, and all this bullshit. The Democratic Party desperately wanted a woman to be president, right? And everybody assumed she would just cakewalk to the nomination, pretty much in the same way people in 2016 thought Jeb Bush would be a really strong candidate, right? But that didn't happen. He defeated Hillary Clinton, which, again, if the Democratic Party had a radar, would have been a clear signal that people were fed up with the old guard and they wanted something to change. They were really frustrated, but they didn't. Anyway, but the biggest reason...
We're still dealing with that in 2026.
No, exactly, right? It's the same people. Like I said, Schumer, Pelosi, it's like basically the same people too. Rahm Emanuel, we'll get to all that. But again, don't want to bury the lead in this particular case. The real issue in 2008 came because the housing market over a period of about a month or so went into massive freefall and then crash, taking a bunch of New York banks with it. It was, we still refer today often as things like the Great Recession. At the time, it was probably the greatest economic calamity since 1929. 2020 may have surpassed that by now, but it was really bad. And so Obama was very fortunate, right? Because that crisis had emerged during the campaign. And McCain and Bush were tied at the hip. And McCain was really burdened with that. That was an albatross. McCain also, because he's another one like Obama who has this great reputation, right? We hear a lot about it. What a great guy, John. Democrats love John McCain, right? McCain gave us Sarah Palin and in many ways jump-started the kind of politics we have now. Palin directly leads to Trump and
the Tea Party.
He was now like one of the good ones, right? Or whatever. And it's kind of funny because Sirota, again, because everyone's talking about Graham Plattner in Maine, and Sirota's been pointing out that McCain was very open about his sexual harassment and young women and things like that, much worse than anything that's even alleged of Plattner, right? So at any rate, but that worked obviously to Obama's advantage during the campaign. And so in November of 08, he won a nomination, and I think progressives, not necessarily the left, but progressives really were inspired. The comparisons to FDR were common. The Hope Change thing, the videos, he was hip. He had celebrities. He had Bruce Springsteen and for the young kind of middle-aged people, Pete Seeger for the old timers. And he had young artists traveling with him. And he was just a rock star, an absolute rock star president, right? But, and I'll throw this to you. I do want to say that in 2008, on that night, when he was elected, I think many of us were choked up and tears were in our eyes. And then that very night, a report came through. They broke in and they said, oh, we've just heard that Barack Obama is going to name Rahm Emanuel as his chief of staff. And the crying stopped and the cursing began because I think we knew where that was headed.
And what we see with Rahm Emanuel as chief of staff, is we see him basically build out his cabinet with a bunch of neo-Clintonites, like former Clinton advisors. He keeps Republicans who had been in the Bush administration in office. I believe Robert Gates, who'd been Secretary of Defense under Bush for the last 2 years, became Secretary of Defense under Obama. He appoints Hillary Clinton to Secretary of State. And then Larry Summers becomes the Director of Economic Policy for the White House. He was former Secretary of State under the Clinton administration. I'm going to talk about that in just a second.
Yeah.
And then he's a Harvard professor. Most notably, most recently, he also turned out to be like best buddies with Jeffrey Epstein, talking about how to hit on young interns or grad students or whatever. But Summers is really, the thing about it is that we'd already been in this era of neoliberalism for probably 20 or 30 years by the time Obama becomes president. And instead of having some more progressive, left-leaning economic policies. It's the Clintonites who come in, led by Larry Summers, facilitated by Rahm Emanuel, to basically bail out the banks as we get into, as this financial crisis has been happening. It's the neoliberals who basically come up with Obama's plan to bail out the banks. So that book that Bob just showed is a book called A Crisis Wasted by Reed Hundt, who was the FCC commissioner for Obama. He was also head of Obama's transition team. But he wrote that book and was very critical of Obama. I think it's mostly on domestic policy. But he says in that book that in collaboration with the former Clinton advisors in the fall of 2008, the Bush administration persuaded Obama to restore the profitability and power of a handful of Wall Street banks that had contributed mightily to hurting almost everyone in the country. And so Hunt's book goes a lot into those early decisions of the Obama administration and how it really tied Obama to neoliberalism, which I don't think was really that hard a task. And then the political failure, this is a quote, "an objective shortcomings of the Obama economic recovery plan can be traced back to summer 2008, when Obama recruited a team of ex-rivals and then also adopted Hillary Clinton's advisors as her own, because people are policy, therefore became a Clinton-style neoliberal. He no longer pursued his own tentative progressive agenda." And so Hunt actually argues that Obama had the potential to be progressive. And I'm throwing that word out a lot, but he had to be potentially be a lot more left of center as far as economic policy goes than he didn't, because he went to bed with the Clinton people.
Yeah, Obama talked a lot about the housing crisis because millions of Americans lost their homes as these banks went under. But as soon as he appoints the likes of Rahm Emanuel, Larry Summers, Henry Paulson, he brings much of the old Clinton team on board, not people like Robert Reich, right? But the kind of establishment of Wall Street Clinton, which is
Larry Summers, the Larry Summers came.
Yeah, I mentioned Larry Summers and Paulson, right?
Richard Rubin, Robert Rubin.
Yeah, the Goldman Sachs people, basically.
Yeah.
And so when that happens, it's pretty clear people are starting to take concern. Within months, just I think in March or April after he was inaugurated, he went to Goldman Sachs and he famously told the assembled bankers there, "I'm the only thing standing between you and the pitchforks," right? And so he took care of them. The two programs that I think really are important here were TARP and HAMP. TARP was the Toxic Assets Relief Program, and that was capitalized at about $800 or $900 billion, which was actually woofully inadequate for the credit people. And that comes out of this too big to fail ideology, right? And it is a huge amount of money given to these banks to bail these banks out. Now, HAMP, which was for homeowner, I can't remember what the acronym is now, but at any rate, that was capitalized much, much lower, I believe $300 billion, so about a third or less of what the Toxic Assets Program was. And only about a tenth of that money ever was spent on the, I think, close to 2 million people who lost their homes, right? So most of these homeowners were stuck, and the number of homes that remained underwater, which meant that they owed more on it than what those houses were worth on a market, was massive, right? And so when it came to put this rhetoric into action on housing, it failed. And it was fairly clear at the time, right? He retained, I think, the support of progressives or liberals, or whatever you're going to call them at the time. But that really was a clear message, I think, that if you were following this closely, you know, you should have seen coming after he had appointed Emanuel and Summers and all these Los Goldman Sachs boys to be his economic advisors, right? Around the same time, he also extended a series of George Bush's tax cuts. I'm going to talk about this, then we'll go to Obamacare, because I think that's important. But the tax cuts, I think, are important too. Obamacare is the big thing everybody talks about, right? And Democrats still run on it as if it was like an answer to the healthcare crisis, right? We're going to say something different. But I think the tax cuts don't get nearly as much attention. Bush went to Congress to get two major tax cuts in 2001 and 2003. And Barack Obama extended them and made 82% of the Bush era cuts permanent, right? So I'm just going to, these numbers I'm going to give you are the Bush-Obama era cuts, because they sync together perfectly, right? Mm-hmm. As much as bailing out the banks, these tax cuts clearly reflected a top-down class war program, right? It was class war from the top down, a continuation of that, which you've already seen, right? The debts from those tax cuts were estimated to rise by 2015 to about $1 trillion a year, right? And most of that was because of the revenue not collected by the tax cuts, right? Think about tax cuts. You don't have money coming in, right? And they're not spending less. And especially with the global war on terror and the wars and everything else, they're certainly not spending less, right? The tax cuts made the deficit worse, if anybody cares about that. What I think is even more important is it creates this even bigger wealth gap. The wealthiest 1% of Americans got 30% of the tax cuts. The next 19% got 43% of the tax cuts, which means the top 20% got 73% of the tax cuts, right? The middle quintiles got about 25%. The bottom quintile, the poorest 60 million plus Americans, got no tax cut. Now, people say they don't pay many taxes anyway, but they weren't doing any better, right? They weren't any better off, right? The lowest quintile saved about $1,400 total between 2003 and 2012, about $140 a year. Nice, right? The largest quintiles received, the fourth quintile received $62,000 a year, and the biggest got over $500,000 a year. Class war from the top down, the Obama tax cuts. That isn't talked about nearly enough. It's continuation of the Bush era tax cuts, and it directly flows into what Trump would do too, right? You have a clear path, Reagan to not Clinton as much, but clearly Reagan to Bush to Obama to Trump. And that's really critical, right? So on that economic program, just like with housing, really this kind of neoliberal approach, more reminiscent of what Reagan or Jimmy Carter before that, or maybe even Nixon, Clinton would do than what you would see from an FDR or a LBJ in the Great Society, all right? Now that, I think, segues to probably the thing he's best known for, which was his attempt to settle the healthcare crisis in America. And it was clear, he made it clear with David Sirota years earlier, he didn't believe in a single-payer system, right? So what do you get?
You get a market-based system, which is, it raised the cost for most Americans and ultimately extended insurance for about 7 or 8% of the country. And actually, I would actually say it's left people very, the Affordable Care Act, I think it was the official bill, it left people pretty unsatisfied. Did a lot to fuel the Trump opposition, Trump, the far right, and Trump actually still run a lot on the American Care Act, even though also in these red states, they also don't want to lose some of their Obamacare because it's all they got. It was based on Romney's healthcare plan in Massachusetts, which is also this market-based healthcare reform initiative.
And they
listed as a triumph of the Obama presidency though.
Yeah, what it did, rather than have a Medicare for all, whatever you want to call it, some kind of national or socialized system where everybody pays in it, what this does is it requires everyone to have health care. In most states, like here in Ohio and in Texas, I was required to have auto insurance, right? Where do I get that from? Do I get that from the state of Texas? Oh, no, I have to go to a private insurer, State Farm, Allstate, whoever, Progressive, whatever, right? The General, whatever, right? I'm paying a private business in order to satisfy a public law, right? That's what Obamacare did. It said you're required to have healthcare, right? So for the 40 million people who didn't have healthcare at the time, now they would be in violation of the law if they didn't have healthcare. So a lot of them can't afford it. So what Obama do? He created markets, right? But again, these are private markets, right? If anybody's on Medicare, you see how that works, right? Most of Medicare, and I didn't know this until, I'm an old man, so I'm on it now. I didn't really even know this until not that long ago, right? Medicare is mostly private insurance, right? United Healthcare, Allstate, whoever, right? So that's what Obamacare did. It said, we will create these markets where we will make these plans available to you. These are private plans, right? Some of them weren't as expensive, but the premiums were massive and the coverage was very limited, right? So people I know who were on them were paying a lot of money and not getting a ton of coverage out of it, right? It also said that you could remain on your parents' health care plan until you were 26. Not a bad idea at all. Great idea, which could have been done separately. They could have just passed a law that said you have to remain on your parents' plan until you're 26, right? So it's this market-based idea. You must have health care. And who lobbied for it? Who was the biggest group lobbying for Obamacare?
The insurance lobby.
The healthcare companies.
The healthcare companies.
In the two or three years after that, the healthcare industry and the insurers made record profits each year. Their profits got bigger each year. They were able to raise rates. They were able to raise fees. more people were covered, but not with good health insurance that was actually affordable. A lot of people were spending, you could say it was better to have something than nothing. But for people, and there were people who were on Medicaid at the time, right? But for people who weren't eligible for Medicaid, who essentially had too much money for Medicaid, but couldn't afford healthcare or didn't have a job, there was squeeze. And so the healthcare options weren't any better. People were on it. People bitched about it a lot. The Republican Party immediately turned and said, this is socialist healthcare. And the Democrats, not shockingly, weren't able to rebut that because they couldn't find their nose in the dark, right? And so you have, it's just, it's the worst of all worlds, right? It's being attacked as socialist healthcare when it does nothing of the sort, right? The Democrats are praising it. Ironically, the Republicans did try to get rid of it in Trump's first year, in first term, and it was John McCain who saved it. McCain, because he knew that as bad as it was, and we're seeing that now, that was the cause of which shutdown was it? There have been so many, I can't even remember anymore, but Obamacare was the cause of, was it the first one this year, the shutdown, or was it the one last year? I don't even remember anymore, but that was the major cause.
It was the end of last year, end of 2025. And, it was over the renewal, right?
Yeah. And I know this is going to be a shocking thing. It's hard to believe. Hold yourself. Chuck Schumer caved in on it. I don't believe it.
But the leadership is strong. The leadership is Democratic leader. It makes me want to go bust through a wall for him or something.
Yeah. It's shocking that he caved in on that because he's just such a strong fighter. We will win. At any rate. But that remains one of the signal achievements. And the Obama people, they do. They hold it up, and that's their gold medal. That's their FIFA Peace Prize. Oh, by the way, Obama is a real prize winner, right? It's fun because Michelle pointed that out during the speech, and she trolled Trump, and liberals love that shit. They ate that up. They don't care what the hell Obama did, but they control Trump. So
performance politics is always there.
Now, there's so much we could talk about. There's a few more areas that I think are important, the environment. And obviously the war and drones. And then I think his political impact is really worth talking about too.
Just to get into the environment, which is really around the climate crisis, it should be noted. I was actually working as a campaigner. I was in DC when Obama had first come in, when he had first been inaugurated, and was having a meeting with a journalist. And she was talking with me and this other colleague about what Obama's priorities were going to be. And it was like, really on this big emphasis about it was going to be healthcare, it was going to be climate, maybe it's going to be education. He's a technocrat and he's a wonk. I think that's really important. I think it's the technocrats that really go for these market-based solutions. And so it was a market-based solution in which Obama went for climate, especially his initial attempt to do something about climate. And so there was a cap and trade bill that was also known as Waxman-Markey. And it was what cap and trade is, that they set a cap or a strict limit on greenhouse gas emissions and then issues tradable permits to industry to emit a specific amount of pollution. If that industry has enough money, then they can just buy the permits and continue to pollute how they will. I think that's an important thing to note.
You know who the creator that was?
Who? I probably do.
Someone who was an advisor to Teddy Kennedy's Senate office named Stephen Breyer.
Oh.
Breyer came up with cap and trade.
Yeah.
And he was rewarded for it.
Yeah, he did. He got a big job.
Yeah.
Maybe the most prestigious job we can have in America is a Supreme Court justice after a professor.
Me and Clarence Thomas. Yeah. I mean, we're near the top of everybody's most admired list.
Yeah, exactly. But with this cap and trade bill was a completely corporate compromise bill to do something. We talk about the single payer issue and how there's a movement for single payer and Medicare for all who were completely shut out of the conversation around Obamacare. There was a thriving environmental and climate movement to really come out of the Bush years to wanting to do things to address the climate crisis. This is post-Katrina. This is post-Al Gore's Inconvenient Truth. And that climate movement was completely shut out as well. And so Waxman, it was completely corporate compromised. I remember writing and seeing articles where the amount of money that industry spent, like oil and gas and coal spent on lobbying against Waxman-Markey, like dwarfed the big green groups. And so it's really important. It actually passed the House, though, died in the Senate. And so then we see Obama try to address the climate in a couple of other different ways. One is the Clean Power Plan, where the EPA actually issued rules on how much coal plants could emit. which actually lasted up until within the last year or so when the Supreme Court killed that as well. And then the other is a big thing with Obama, which we're not going to get into that much today, are like our multilateral international agreements. And so the other one that they really like dived into was around the Paris Agreement, the Paris Climate Agreements, which was negotiated in Paris in late 2015 to get a number of countries to agree to reduction of emissions. John Kerry, who at that point was Obama's Secretary of State, did a lot. He later became Biden's climate czar, did a lot to negotiate that. But as soon as Trump came in, he threw that out, right? So that's all important to note on Obama's climate record, that it's always this sort of more corporate approach. And then I want to talk about one other thing, which I was actually, this is the sort of work that was much more involved in the 2010s, which was around fossil fuel extraction. So we actually ran a campaign against Obama and his EPA around mountaintop removal coal mining, which was this devastating practice where they blew off the tops of mountains in southern Appalachia. And we were able to eventually get them to stop issuing so many permits. But the administration was actually very resistant to it because they didn't want to disrupt industry. They didn't want to disrupt the financiers who finance the industry. They didn't want to disrupt Democratic politicians in those states who were actually very much supported by the industry, people like Joe Manchin and Robert Byrd. So that's all worth noting. And then the other big fight that happens in the 2010s around fossil fuels or around pipelines, the two most notable ones are one around the Keystone XL pipeline, where we actually saw a climate movement really manifest and take a lot of action. It was a holistic approach, but included a two weeks every day of sit-ins at the White House pressuring Obama to reject the permit for the Keystone XL pipeline. It was a permit that was going to cross over from Canada. Eventually, because of the pressure from the climate movement, Obama actually did reject the pipeline. But what happens with that pipeline, same with the Paris Agreement, is that Trump approves it. But because of all the resistance, the pipeline was pretty much dead. And then the other pipeline battle, which is actually really significant in the end of the Obama years, which is the Dakota Access Pipeline. And so there was like a big fight over that where we saw tens of thousands of people, including pretty significant numbers of natives from all over North America were part of that. What I want to say there, which is really important, is that Obama also ended up rejecting that after it was like months of a pretty hard-fought campaign, which included a lot of police brutality, infiltration, lawsuits, all kinds of stuff that come out of that. Obama did end up blocking that permit. When Trump came in just a couple of months later, he approved it. So there's a little bit of a pattern here. It's like we had to push really hard on Obama, which included a lot of police violence against activists. But then it's also noted that most of it didn't actually stay because the far right came into power.
A lot of those scenes, especially from DAPL, kind of look like Minneapolis with ICE. And maybe it's cynical to suggest this, but Biden did the same thing with Cuba in the last day of his presidency. You wait until the very last minute because you know that Trump is going to come in and undo it anyway, right? Had he taken these steps in 2012 or 2013, they'd have been baked in. You never know. But Obama's people love to give him credit for stuff that was utterly symbolic, nothing but.
Hey, the one other thing I wanted to throw in there that he did as part of his climate agenda was he appointed a green job czar, which was Van Jones. And so the right wing, because Van Jones had this radical communist background, the right wing kind of went nuts and got him fired for all
intents and purposes. And now he's their guy.
And now he's their guy, right? I don't know how different he is. I don't know if he was just faking it till you make it, but now he's like CNN's Zio guys.
He did get Soros money. I'm serious. I think he got a shit ton of money from Soros.
I'm sure he did.
So he did get the Soros money. The last thing, more or less, but I think, and I can't spend a lot of time, but I think it's important. It's something I studied, kind of like you do the environment, is war and drone war, right? One of the key reasons he wanted to know the economic crash, the biggest, but also the war. He took a strong, finally ended up taking a strong stand against the war after it was clear that the American people wanted out. Much like we're seeing today among a lot of Democrats. I admire people who've taken the stand against Israel, especially like Mamdani and others. But it's also very clear that most Americans want this to happen as well, right? And so Obama did that. Did he significantly change the war or end it? Not really, right? what he did in many ways, and you'll see this, this is like Vietnamization, right? You change the nature of the war, but you don't change the war itself. So Obama comes in, he certainly does start to withdraw American troops. So the number of American troops in those theaters is reduced, kind of like Vietnamization, right? But that doesn't end the war. Just as Nixon switched to an air war, Operation Linebacker, Christmas bombings, all kinds of stuff like that. Obama, in many ways, originated drone warfare. Now we're very familiar with it, right? It's, I think, the typical form of warfare. We see it everywhere. We see it in our own cities. We see it in Iran. We see it in Iraq, Israel, you name it, right? At the time, during this global war on terror, there was this real concern that Al-Qaeda and other groups were hiding out in various countries, especially in Pakistan. So Obama began to conduct huge numbers of drone attacks against alleged or purported terrorist hideouts in places like this, Yemen, especially Pakistan, right? Because they were safe havens for terrorists like Al-Qaeda. Obama began a massive drone offensive, claiming that these attacks would only be waged against legitimate targets. Attacks by ICE would only be conducted against the worst of the worst or something like that. And the same thing, right? The drone war, however, didn't involve personnel, right? These drones were being operated by computer technicians in Omaha, right? And they were attacking in Pakistan and Yemen and places like that. In fact, at the time, the Washington Post, and this is before it went full on crazy Bezos Trump, said no president has ever relied so extensively on the secret killing of individuals to advance the nation's security goals. Obama at the 2012, what do you call when they get together and they make stupid jokes? The press correspondence dinner. Is that it?
White House correspondence dinner.
White House correspondent made a joke. I'm really good at killing people, right? That's his idea of humor, right? Also in 2012, there was a major study done by legal experts who really exposed the entire drone campaign. It had killed over 2,000 people, a large number of them civilians who had no connection to any kind of political group. Obama said that they were surgically precise attacks. The report said that they weren't. Famously, Obama attacked a wedding party and killed, I forget, many dozens of people. He attacked homes. He attacked, I believe, a funeral at one point, a funeral party. He attacked also, he engaged, and this is something that liberals have justifiably, legitimately attacked Trump for, and Hegseth, right? He double tapped. Obama conducted a lot of double taps where you attack a group, and then as humanitarian workers or aid workers or medical personnel go back to help, you attack again. He did attack funerals the same way, right? A couple of the people killed were actually American citizens. Nothing came of it, right?
It was a 16-year-old kid.
16-year-old. The legal report in 2016 said drones hovered 24 hours a day over Northwest Pakistan, striking homes, vehicles, and public spaces without warning. Their presence terrorizes men, women, and children, giving rise to anxiety and psychological trauma among civilian communities. Those living under drones have to face the constant worry that a deadly strike may be fired at any moment, and the knowledge that they are powerless to protect themselves. The U.S. practice of striking one area multiple times and evidence that it has killed rescuers makes both community members and humanitarian workers afraid or unwilling to assist injured victims. Some community members shy away from gathering in groups out of fear that they may attract the attention of drone operators. Some parents keep their children home, and children injured or traumatized by strikes have dropped out of school. In addition, families who have lost loved ones or their homes in drone strikes now struggle to support themselves. All right. By the way, we forgot to mention earlier, this came courtesy of the 2009 Nobel Peace Prize winner. In fact, at one point, I think it was in Yemen, Obama waged the state the drone attack against the Doctors Without Borders installation. It's the only time in history when a Nobel Prize Peace Prize winner bombed and killed another Nobel Peace Prize winner, right? And it's funny because recently you're seeing a lot of right-wingers because of what Hegseth and Trump are doing in the Caribbean and in Iran. Probably the Manav School was a double tack. Part of it was a double tack. Obviously, Israel's doing this in Gaza in the most horrific ways imaginable, right?
In Lebanon now, right?
And people saying, well, you didn't say anything about Obama. They're right. You didn't. They're right. The scale of what's happening now is far worse, dwarfs what Obama did, right? But the intent and the impact was the same. Barack Obama, if the old Noam Chomsky line, every American post-war president was a war criminal. Clearly with Obama, that's a very easy case to make, right?
There's also a Chomsky line that says that Bush used to torture them. but Obama just killed them.
Yeah.
Which I think is worth noting as well. And we're not even getting into Obama. There's the badging of the war in Afghanistan, which continued through the Obama years. There's the dissolving of a stable government in Libya, which the Obama and Clinton people were part of.
Honduras.
Yeah, Honduras and Syria. Honduras. So,
yeah.
And the rise of ISIS in northern Iraq, northern Syria.
Surveillance here at home.
Yep. Yep.
Went after journalists, James Risen.
Whistleblowers.
Whistleblowers, journalists, Snowden, and was Assange during, I think that was during the Obama years too, Assange and Snowden, yep. Right? Because they had released all this information about domestic surveillance programs, right? So he was an American president, right? He was smooth. He was slick, right? But at the end of the day, he took care of the corporate and lords as the same as everybody else did. The banks, the corporations on TARP, the bailout of people to prevent the people from pitchforks, the tax cuts, cap and trade, the wars. He took care of that class.
Yeah. I have one question for you on the foreign policy stuff before we talk about the last thing we're going to talk about, which is his politics as a result of Obama. Which is, he is credited with opening up relations with Cuba, and he's also credited with the nuclear deal with Iran. And I'm just wondering how you see that fitting in.
Yeah, no, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I wanted to say that and I forgot. To be fair, no, I would applaud both of those. Cuba especially. It was the first substantial move in that direction, really, ever, right? He went to Cuba, he opened it up for Americans, not fully, but made it way easier to get there. In 2016 and 17, you started seeing like millions of Americans travel to Cuba, where before that it had been like a very small number. I was there in June of 2017, or this time. I was there 9 years ago today, in fact, right? Ironically, I left the day after Trump announced that he was going to get rid of all the Obama reforms, right? But there was really a sign of hope there. People were happy. The economy was better off. You could go get a meal at a private place. It was just different. And I talked to people there who were supporters, they were older supporters of the revolution, who were really kind of happy to see this happening. Clearly, there were people who were surveilling, there were government officials surveilling neighborhoods. But at the same time, everybody I talked to felt free to just blast. At the time, I think Raul had already stepped down. It was Diaz Canal. I'm not really sure. Maybe it was still Raul. But at any rate, it was different. And the Iran thing, as we're seeing now, Trump's current agreement is actually, in fact, worse than the JCPOA that Obama did 10 years ago, right? So on those two, and I wish Obama would have taken a stronger stand on both, but the reality is, given the nature on Iran, the fact that he was doing that, he was catching hell from his own people. Remember, Hillary Clinton had vowed time and again to bomb Iran, right? Just like McCain had. The Democratic Party, especially the AIPAC Democrats like Schumer and the whole Democratic Party basically was opposed to the Iran agreement. So I actually think that Iran and Cuba legit deserve applause. Absolutely. Two important things that, you know, I couldn't say the same about Clinton or JFK or any of them. But, and the last thing, which I think is really important, is because you and I have talked about this a lot, is Obama went a long way toward destroying the Democratic Party. And I think where we are today is to a large degree the product of him and Rahm Emanuel and
the Clintons.
Who was Harry Reid the Democratic leader at the time? Reid was probably better than Obama, actually, in a lot of those things. But when Obama was first elected, if you look at a map, and I wish I'd pulled it out, you mentioned it right before, and I wish I'd thought of it. If you look at a map of 2008, 2010, a map of the U.S., and it'll be obviously blue and red, but not based on the states in the Electoral College, but based on who ran the legislatures in those particular states. So all blue would mean that the Democrats controlled both houses in that state legislature, state Senate. All red obviously would mean that the Republicans controlled both the state Senate and the state legislature. And then some were mixed. They'd have stripes or different color, whatever. One party contained the Senate, one party contained the control, the legislature, right? If you look at those maps in 08 and 10, even a little into not as much in 2012, they're still going to be mostly blue. And then boom, you start to see a rapid change. To a large degree, it's because Obama didn't give a shit about local politics. He also didn't care about judges and judicial appointments all that much either.
Yeah. Right? The things that really strike me is, one, I think that we've kind of already gone into how the Obama years were a continuation of the neoliberal project, whatever you want to call it. And the politics of NAFTA, which we've talked a lot about, which has actually really done a lot to derail Democratic politics and American politics, is Obama continues on with that. He actually tries to pass trade agreements, which actually that was part of his engagement plan with Asia, was like trade agreements, right? Yeah,
chips.
Yeah. And so I think that's actually really worth noting. And to look at the electoral map, Obama won Iowa twice. He won Ohio twice. He right and other
North Carolina, Florida.
North Carolina, Florida.
Indiana.
But the continuation of those free trade policies, particularly in those Midwest states, was actually a really important thing to note. And that's partly also what burns the Democrats. He also didn't care that much about Democratic politics, but then he also is all in on these free trade policies, which is Larry Summers and Rahm Emanuel. Yeah. And the other thing we see here is the rise of the Tea Party, which is just, I actually think, is a little bit of a racist response to the first Black president. But it's also really worth noting that they actually really captured the Republican Party. And Trump is a byproduct of the Tea Party, which starts in 2010. I think that's actually an important thing to note. And that's fueled by, you know, free trade, has fueled by propaganda they put out about Obamacare and what have you. So it's really worth noting that there's his actually inept at dealing with actual politics and also trying to rise above it, which was actually a big thing. They go low, we go high, all that sort of stuff.
No drama Obama
is really worth noting. If he had fought some of those battles, then maybe we wouldn't be as bad a dire situation as we are right now.
It'd be stupid to say race and racism are irrelevant here. It's America. We know it is. Clearly, the Tea Party, there's a lot of people who are upset. Donald Trump's political career really got jump-started by going after Obama and the birth certificate and Kenyan socialist and all that kind of shit, right? So no doubt. However, liberals, that's their go-to now. That's the only thing they say. Obama couldn't do any of this because of racism, right? And racism is real. However, in both 2008 and 2012, he won big victories. Not quite as big as 2012, but still really big victories. I think they're the biggest since 1964, I think the two Obama victories are the biggest since 1964, right? Now, Reagan's would have been, obviously. But at any rate, he was a Nobel Prize winner in 2009. Or in early 2008, Arlen Specter jumped parties to join the Democrats, which gave them allegedly that veto-proof majority. They had 60 Democratic senators, and he used all that capital for Obamacare, right? And really not much else. But even after 2012, the Democrats lost some seats. They still had the Senate. They still had the House. Obama really wasn't a fighter, never was a fighter, never has been, still isn't a fighter. You notice he's been radio silent about everything that's going on, about ICE, about everything, right? Doesn't say a word. One of the things that always really annoyed me at the time, when Ruth Bader Ginsburg first announced she had cancer, which is really early in his first term, it was like 09 or 10, right? I was the asshole who said, they got to get her out now. Oh, you can't say that. And he never pushed, right? He had a luncheon with her. I don't even know if he was, I think he was afraid to bring it up, right? And Ruth Bader Ginsburg insisted that she be replaced by the first female president, Hillary Clinton. How'd that work out, right? And Obama also punted on when Scalia died and he nominated Merrick Garland. There were ways around that. Would they have worked? I don't know, but he didn't try. He and Durbin, who was the head of judiciary, just threw in the towel, said nothing we can do. Obama was never a fighter, never would be a fighter, never had been a fighter. Bragged about being a community organizer and all this stuff. He was corporatist. I give him props on Cuba and Iran, actually. Other than that, I don't know. Not much. I'd say, damn.
He made us feel good. He gave nice speeches.
45 minutes. I dislike him even more. I'm just talking to you for 45 minutes. I already was pretty much down on the guy. Now it's, wow, it's worse than I thought. And I study this shit. So.
Oh, yeah. Oh.
Yeah, he took care of Goldman Sachs. He listened to Larry Summers instead of people like...
Paul Krugman, Joe Stiglitz,
but the other guy, Robert Wright. Jesus Christ, I couldn't think of it. I was going to be an asshole and say, you know, that little guy who was in the cabinet, Robert Reich, you didn't listen to Reich or Stiglitz or people like that, right? And there were messages. He knew the Democratic Party was getting, he didn't care. Same with judicial appointments. Rahm Emanuel said, we don't care, right? And so this is where we are, right? He could have forced Ruth Bader Ginsburg out. Definitely forced her out, absolutely.
I think the luncheon that you mentioned happened in like 2013 after he was reelected, but before the 2014 midterms where they knew they were going to the Senate.
Yeah. Yeah. My point was like, as soon as she announced it, they should have said, you're gone. Goodbye.
Yeah, exactly.
You think that
What do you think the odds are that Alito or Thomas is gone before the election?
It's not out. It's definitely very possible. Although the clock is ticking, but yeah, but it's very possible.
Democrat Senate's going to stop him?
Yeah, you know? That's true.
Fetterman's going to have a, what do you call it? A filibuster. Fetterman's going to stand up there and talk. Come on. He's gonna do whatever he wants. Yeah. Schumer's going to get him the next time. That's what they always say. We'll get him the next. At any rate.
Strongly worded letter.
What was the percentage of Obama voters who voted for Trump in 2016? I forget. It was really big. People, two-time Obama voters voted for Trump. It was like 30% or something.
Yeah. And in those states, that's Milwaukee, and that's like Des Moines. And
Obama also helped destroy Bernie Sanders. That was, Hillary Clinton was his handpicked candidate. He wanted the first black president to be
twice, qualified. 2022.
Yeah, first woman president, right? And yeah, Obama in 2020 made all those late night phone calls, right? He also helped scuttle the NBA's boycott plans in 2020. He's compromising. He's corporatist. He's a smooth liberal corporatist. It's corporate liberalism, the old corporate neoliberalism, right? Definitely not like Trump, but he clearly segued for Trump, clearly greased the skids just in the same way that Biden would too, partly because his policies were so similar, but also because he just wouldn't fight politically. And the Democrats, I've often said, they should replace the jackass as their party symbol with a possum or an ostrich. They're either dead in the middle of the road or they got their head in the dirt.
Yeah.
That's Barack Hussein Obama. Remember, Oprah Winfrey called him the chosen one. He was a rock star. Women swooned over him. He was on the cover of magazines, Nobel Prize winner. He puts out his list of favorite songs and favorite books, and liberals still get all giddy about it. He does TV shows. He hangs out on Geffen's yacht. He's worth who knows how much money now. And now he has his own library, and liberals are living in the past, reliving the glory of 2000.
He has a new HBO show coming out with Larry David.
With Larry David? Oh, boy.
Yeah. Unless we have anything else, I was going to leave it there. I think we did pretty good talk about the Obama years here.
This is why you need to listen to Green and Red, because I don't know. There are others who can do this, obviously. Certainly not the only people who have been critical of Barack Obama. But yeah, it's a good reason to listen to this, because you're not going to get it on a lot of these other ones, these described experts.
No.
Anyway, yeah, it's unfortunate. It's sad. It makes you sad. It makes you angry. At any rate, keep the fight. Good news out of New York last night. We're recording this on the 24th, so that's good. The three, whatever you want to call them, left or Democratic Socialist or whatever, primary candidates won. The Democrat establishment's freaking out. The Republicans at Fox News are freaking out. There's a good chance that a candidate who the Democratic establishment hates is going to win in Maine.
And in Michigan.
Electoral politics isn't going to save us. The midterms, if they go off even, ain't going to save us. But you got to look for a little bit of hope. People are rising up against data centers. But yeah, Barack Obama, unfortunately, is the standard, not an outlier at all.
Yep. Folks, if you like what you're hearing, make sure you check us out on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, Blue Sky. If you're watching this on YouTube, hit that subscribe button. If you're listening to us on an audio platform, give us a rate and review. And if you really like us, go to greenredpodcast.org and hit the support button or become a patron at patreon.com/greenredpodcast. Until we speak again, yes, we can. Hope and change, all of that stuff. Hopey and changey. And the real message from the Green Red Podcast is make trouble and misbehave. And we'll talk to you again soon.